Hi, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Nick Gillespie, Matt Welch, Catherine Mangu-Ward about news and politics, and today we're all in the same room instead of being disembodied spirits communicating through the internet, so that's cool. And we're going to discuss Venezuelan empanadas, the recent terrorist attack in New York City, whether Russia stole the 2016 election, the Republican tax plan, and if we have time, we're going to wail on socialism. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Andrew.
It's all wailing on socialism, isn't it?
It's substantial.
That's just the subtext.
I'm going to check the pie charts, but I think you're right about that. This week in Venezuela, President Maduro held a four-hour national address, as you do in thug countries. And while that happened, quietly pulled an empanada out of his desk and ate it. Meanwhile, Venezuela, which is a socialist country, is in the throes of starvation. Last year, people resorted to eating zoo animals. That was one of the stories that happened. Their currency is terrible to the point where they've, in certain stores, quit counting it. They just weigh stacks of it. It's gotten that bad. So him eating it on an empanada on television is kind of an FU to the population. Catherine, what's going on in Venezuela?
Nothing good. All the bad things. Right. So Venezuela is obviously a huge mess. Reason has been covering this, everything from the fact that the new plan is everyone's going to eat rabbits. That's going to be fine. They're going to do the rabbits thing. I think North Korea tried that, too. The food aid is distributed primarily to loyalists. People are starving. There's no medicine. And yeah, it's clear if you watch the video that Maduro thought the camera wasn't going to be on him. Like, he's kind of like looking over like he's going to pay attention to somebody
else. It's
kind
of endearing for a dictator, isn't it?
But you can see him pull out the desk drawer. And like, I'm not going to lie. Do I keep weird snacks in my desk? Yes, I do.
But do you have a warming tray in one of your...
I wish.
I mean, this is...
I wish, but...
Aspiration.
As the fire marshal in the D.C. office, I have to say you can't have a hot plate. I'm going to forbid that just right out the gate.
Man, but I need the candles and the hot plate for my dorm. Right, so like, you know, the glories of living in a consumerist capitalist society include that everyone has snacks in their desks, and that is as God intended. When you are literally the only person in the country that has desk snacks, it seems like a bit of a dick move to watch, to eat it on TV.
I thought it was like a new Taco Bell ad or something. And maybe he...
Taco Bell debuts their new empanada line, they're just going to use
the Maduro,
this.
You know, with...
it's empty, though.
Extreme...
It's the Maduro empanada, when you bite into it, there's just air inside.
But it's more signs that we're living in a Philip K. Dick novel or that Idiocracy is true. I mean, because this is... it's insane. I mean, and at this point, it must be he's trying to be killed or assassinated, because you don't do that.
You can't retire. It's not an option. So you just have to wait to get
shot. Well, you'll recall that like 6 months ago, there were allegations that the government had hired someone to fake an assassination attempt via helicopter, I think.
Yeah, it was like the Claude Van Damme, or whatever his name is, of Venezuela.
Jean-Claude
Van Damme had hijacked a helicopter and thrown grenades at the Supreme Court or something.
Yeah. Right. And while I am generally anti-fat shaming, I do want to note that Maduro is kind of chubbed up lately, just generally speaking, which, again, kind of a dick move.
If you ever, you know, lived through the kind of wrenching poverty that I had to experience as a younger man, Catherine, you would know that it's easy to get a little fat around the edges when you don't have any food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's what's happening with Maduro.
Okay.
Yeah. And by bodily definitions makes me quite the proletariat, as I am real thin. So well done me. Real quick, usually socialism is a great way when applied to agriculture to make large groups of people starve to death. Mm-hmm. We on the Independence, we used to have a communist on regularly, Matt.
And Jesse Myers.
Jesse Myers, who's a great guy, and I would go drinking with him.
Matt Welch,
but
the communist guest.
He would claim that technology could fix all the ills of communism, that the problem had been an insufficient amount of computing power. Now that we have computers, communism can work. But we have them, and they're still having starvation in Venezuela.
There's a line of thought. It kind of like dovetails with sort of universal basic income things and robotics that, like, okay, there's just a set amount of work. If we just get the robots to do the work, then we don't have to work, and we'll just use the robots' money, and we could sit around and, like, smoke hefty bags full of pot and not be too worried about a work ethic. I think it's the Thad Russell, like, dream come true there, to be honest.
That's why cinch sack technology was invented, actually, by Hefty for the smoking of marijuana.
You know what? I forgot about the cinch sack.
What is the cinch sack?
This must be an old person thing.
No. It's just people with adults, you know what a hefty cinch sack is.
It's just a little plastic kind of zipper teeth kind of situation there.
You mean a Ziploc bag? Is that what you're talking about?
No, it's not a Ziploc bag. It's
yeah, I'll look it up on the internet. I don't want to derail too much of the conversation.
Our poor
but this is
listeners, Jesus Christ.
This is this is what late capitalism throws
this
off.
This is why we don't get together very often.
We had this bit for Radio Free Reason that broadcasts in Venezuela. We wanted to throw a bone to the people that were watching their leader eat an empanada. But I might move on to the next one, which is a little bit more.
Well, if I linger a bit, like the smell of the empanada after Maduro's burp in the face of starvation. There isn't really to me, the Venezuela story, and, you know, this kind of obviously political discourse in America has gone, you know, completely ridiculous under Trump. It's been moving that way for a long time. But, what is does anybody have an end game for Venezuela? Because even just a few months ago, we were all kind of talking about this seemed to be at the very end of the line for Maduro. There were popular revolt starting, et cetera. And I mean, does anybody have any sense of when that's going to come?
This was actually the piece that we ran in the magazine by Francisco Toro a year and a half ago, where he described the sort of problem of scholarship on recovering from socialist dictatorships, which is that nobody thought that any countries were going to have to do that again. So there isn't very much scholarship on it.
Wow.
That, like, a bunch of people had done histories, obviously, sort of, you know, anecdotally, well, this is what happened here, this is what happened here. But they're very bound up in a kind of global move away from that ideology. And that's, like, obviously we've already experienced that global move away, and yet people keep trying it. So there actually is no guidebook, I don't think. There's certainly nothing from the kind of scholarly side of the equation about how we get from, you know, riots, starvation, Maduro empanada shenanigans to a functional country.
Again. I think it's more that you don't have the scholarship about how the last 10% of the dive goes and the beginning of the end starts. I think there is a pretty, when countries shift from authoritarianism or even like starvation mismanagement and start getting better, there is pretty good scholarship on that. You know, what Singapore did since 1950 has been studied.
Right, that's right. Our ability to pinpoint the when does it get bad enough.
Yes. And how
moment.
And how does that happen? I think everyone's completely at a loss. The one thing that troubles me vis-a-vis U.S. policy is that Trump, in a couple of speeches, including down in Cuba and elsewhere, has kind of asserted that the U.S. is going to take a more vigorous role in either regime change or just like being involved in what happens in Venezuela.
That's great.
And also Cuba. It's very Monroe doctrine-y, because otherwise in other parts of the world, he's like, it's their sphere of influence. We're not going to be as aggressively in that. But he seems to have a sense that if it's close to home and it's commie, then we're going to get our fingers in it. I don't think that's necessarily a good idea.
Well, we have a very good track record in picking foreign leaders, and Trump has a great track record in picking cabinet positions. So I would think between the two, picking the next president of Venezuela should just be a home run for him.
This problem. Good
point. Yeah. I'm going to kick it to New York then, guys, because earlier this week, New York experienced the most deadly terror attack since 9/11. A man named Saifullo Habibullevic Saipov drove a pickup down a bike trail and murdered 8 people and injured several more. He is a immigrant from Uzbekistan, which factors into all of the rhetoric that's been coming out of the Trump administration since then. He came over on a green card lottery, which has been described also as a diversity visa. And he's also been captured, unlike most deadly terrorists. So he's going to be presumably brought to trial, and we'll figure out what we're going to do with him. Trump has been fairly stern in his responses so far. He has called for the death penalty. He's indicated we might send Saipov to Gitmo. And he's implicated Chuck Schumer as somehow responsible for this through his support of the diversity lottery program, I think in the 1990s or so, but sort of picked him. A lot of this rhetoric, Nick, strikes me as very authoritarian, very strong man. He talks about how the justice system is too slow and we need to figure out a way to make it quicker. Not in this instance, but previously he talked about how in China their trials take 24 hours, and then the bullet, they make the family pay for the bullet. So while I think we're all fairly anti-terrorist here, I'm a little bit concerned about the sort of abrogation of due process that appears to be what he's rooting for.
Yeah, but I mean, he doesn't really have anything to do with that, I think. And I'll say this, I was in New York when that happened, and one of the things that is kind of inspiring, I suppose, I mean, you know, nothing is good about this, but that it didn't really faze people. And that you get on with your life, and you as soon as the path was opened, it was filled again with people biking and walking and whatnot. And it seems to me that that's actually the proper response to terror, you know, which is to you work in various ways and through intelligence agencies and things like that that stay within the law, but you minimize the opportunities that people have, and then you ignore it as much as possible. It seems to me that that's, you know, kind of a wise and proper response. And in that sense, New York may be, you know, really a model for the rest of America, despite often seeming to be at odds with it.
It almost felt like watching not just Trump, but like Lindsey Graham, who I might have more contempt for his response to all this. And John McCain, too. Like, this shows why we have to try them as enemy combatants. It's like a classic take on kind of slippery slope of stupid war on terror, civil liberties infringements. An enemy combatant was a way to describe something that we hadn't seen before, which is that you're not wearing a uniform and you're against us and you're in a foreign country doing bad stuff. We got to have it.
And you're on a battlefield, actually. I mean, it was not simply, you weren't just like a spy or something like that.
You're so, not, you know, just, you were stateless soldier. You were burning, kind of a stateless soldier. Yeah. That's what it meant. And so it's as if, you know, the Lindsey Grahams of the world's like, oh, great, we've got a new category.
Catechism.
And so let's use it against people who are at this point like totally American or at least U.S. residents for a long time. And it's as if he and others have been trying to drum up hysteria. And you're absolutely right, Nick. I mean, it was Halloween in New York, and I was in a neighborhood, and everyone just went trick-or-treating. Like, no one talked about it. It happened 4 miles away. And, you know, there was the Halloween parade in Greenwich Village that it just took place, you know, a couple hours later, because it always does. And why wouldn't it? And that is, I think, lights the way forward to a better response, Nick was saying.
I mean, it sounds like then that you're kind of saying this stuff is going to happen and we should, you know, try and not be psychologically rocked by it. Is there anything that the Trump administration has said that indicates we could have better screened them? I mean, I know that he's talking about visa restrictions. Catherine, do you have any thoughts on whether or not, you know, the merit-based system that he's championing would have been better than the diversity visa program that he thinks caused it?
I mean, this is we always are figuring out a way to screen out the last terrorist for the next terrorist attack. And it's frequently, you know, when you are working with such a tiny data set, there's no way to make rational policy choices about it, right? So you remember during the Boston Marathon bombing, there was this whole cycle of, oh, well, they were asylees. Oh, no, they were children of asylees. Maybe they were refugees. No, they were probably just snuck in. And it was like, whatever your particular hobby horse was on immigration.
We have to work more closely with Russian intelligence.
Right, right. We had a whole round of like, well, the Russians knew that these guys were bad. And
they were sharing that information.
Our government and the Russian government basically used the same list of bad people, then surely we would be safer. Like, what the hell? So I think, you know, we'll have a round of that with this guy, too. I'm far more troubled by the we need quicker justice response of Trump. I mean,
yeah, I think that our justice system is one of the pillars of government that I think is actually doing a decent job right now compared to like Congress and the executive branch. Like, I'd rather they not tinker with that.
But this broader idea of, you know, the thing that's really wrong here in the United States is that it sometimes takes a really long time to litigate extremely serious charges while also, by the way, holding the person so that they can't do any additional
but,
harm.
You know, this is where and it might just be Trump fatigue, but, you know, I've stopped really giving a shit, you know, what he has to say about a lot of this stuff, partly because he's shown himself to be in many ways a paper tiger. Most of the stuff, and I think actually, Matt, you wrote about this recently about deregulation, where Trump has probably done about as much as he can do by appointing people at agencies like, you know, EPA, FDA, FCC, EPA, FDA, FCC. And then, you know, and they can implement some rollback of regulation or have some immediate impact. But really, it's, you know, it's congressional power that sets the rules. And I think that's also true of, you know, the wheels of the justice system. And, you know, Trump really hasn't been able to do very much. Partly
as a matter of
because,
fact, he either an interview or a tweet storm over the last 24, 36 hours, he was saying a bunch of kind of like barky, authoritarian sounding things like, I wish I could just, you know, tell my FBI to go and prosecute Hillary Clinton.
He wants to get more involved in FBI, DOJ investigations of Hillary. And
it was an expression of impotence, you know, like in frustration that you can't just win the presidency and start ordering everyone around and what to do.
It sucks when you find out you're not actually king. That's got to be a letdown.
One hand, as Maduro can tell you, it's good to be the king. Yeah. Then on the other hand, it's kind of like it's not all it's cracked up to be when you have institutions that have been building up for 200 and some odd years.
So going back to your comment, Nick, about him being a paper tiger, if you could separate the damage Trump has done versus the outrage that he causes on Twitter regularly, what percentage would you put him at?
Well, math, particularly hypothetical math, imaginary
math. It's the
math.
Only kind of math I can do, actually,
I'm really bad at that. But it's, you know, there have been a couple of things that he's done and a couple of appointments, I think, that are good. Ajit Pai at the FCC is a good example of that, who is rolling back and going through the process to get rid of net neutrality rules, which I think is a win for free speech and a freer internet. But beyond that, the real misses on Trump, and they're very tied up with the Republican Party in terms of things like the Obamacare repeal and replace. If he had been more serious all along, and if he had been seen as a more serious candidate, maybe they would have actually had a law that went, you know, all the way to his desk that actually changed things. When you look at stuff like the tax reform bill, it's awful, and the budget stuff. And so in many ways, it's not even whether or not he's powerful or not, but he, you know, we have a Republican Party that has sucked balls for all of the 21st century, and he's doing nothing to kind of lead it to a level of efficiency or even bare minimum competence in delivering the type of legislation that can be voted on, much less actually be good for the country.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I enjoyed the sucking balls comment. We'll put that in the description for the podcast episode. Okay. Catherine, death penalty. Do you think it should ever be used?
Oh man, we're doing full college dorm room stuff here, huh?
Yeah.
So the death penalty is actually.
By the way, let's be clear: the day isn't long enough, and there aren't enough drugs left to make a debate over capital punishment interesting, even in a college dorm.
That's right. So I'm here. Are you ready for my? Because I feel that way. The death penalty is one of those topics that I recognize other people feel very strongly about, and I struggle to care actually all that much. So I'm an American hero, obviously. It's in fact, we use the death penalty quite rarely. It is frequently misapplied. It's a big garbagey shit show, probably just general principle. The U.S. government should not have the power of life and death over its citizens. That includes the draft. That includes the death penalty. That includes bazillions of other things. But this variation on U.S. government abuses its power of life and death over its citizenry seems to be not a special case. It's just, you know, I would take it off the table because the government's not good at anything, and this is a big deal.
Yeah, like in Oklahoma, we've killed a bunch of innocent people. This thing called DNA evidence came out.
Yeah, that's kind of a big deal.
It came to our state like 3 years ago.
Oklahoma has trouble mixing the drugs right to actually use an execution.
That's right. The apothecary.
Yeah, just kind of across the board, we've done for those listening, if you don't know the reference, somebody cut off the kill people drug that we were using, and so we made up our own. We went in the back and like
good. You go into the garage.
There's a compounding pharmacy called the Apothecary Shop with two P's and an E.
Is it like a smiley face at the end?
Probably. I think
poison.
It's based in Louisiana, but it turns out to provide a bunch of execution drugs to several southern states after respectable drug companies were like, oh, hey, we're kind of morally complicit in the shitty death penalty. Maybe we shouldn't sell these drugs.
Why don't they go to like Dr. Death's nephew or whatever? Is there still a Kevorkian in the game?
I hope so. But because, of course, the very, very, very specific combination of drugs that you have to use are written into unchangeable law, right? To tweak that law would be to fight the death penalty.
Can the government at least buy that at a discount? I can see this becoming like an Elizabeth Warren thing,
we just want to re-import death drugs. The problem is that they do mandate that the drugs be manufactured domestically manufactured in-state.
Any Dutch companies aren't going to get our money.
Yeah. There's a whole microcosm of government stupidity inside the question of where they even get the drugs to do the executions, which are not legally solid anyway.
Isn't the ultimate libertarian argument against the death penalty, which works for me, is that the state is supposed to keep citizens safe, and it should use the least amount of violence necessary to do that. And so by keeping somebody in jail for life, you've accomplished that goal. So the death penalty is not necessary. I know a couple of years ago we did a documentary at Reason TV about how much it costs to put people on, keep people on death row in California, much less actually execute them. And it, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it is so astronomically expensive that even the hardest court death penalty advocates in California are like, no, really, you know, this is, I mean, it's like bullet train level ridiculous spending on, you know, something that has no clear effect on crime or people's feelings or anything.
I think the data is conclusive on that. I suspect that the public sentiment's probably going back that direction with, you know, Joe Arpaio, who's finally been dislodged. There is that kind of, particularly where I'm from, this kind of logic of you did a bad thing, so we're going to hit you in the head with a brick. And punish you as terribly as we can, and that'll teach you, and you'll learn and come back and become a social media manager.
Well, supposedly the support for the death penalty is at a historic low in the United States and throughout, I think, most of the West.
Which I think is probably a combination of DNA evidence and eroding confidence somewhat, but it's also that we don't live in a crime-infested, you know, shithole that we did 25 years ago, like where we're sitting, for example.
Mm. Yeah, all good things.
I was looking at some of the statistics about conviction rates for people charged with terrorism in response to this Trump quote about how we're just so easy on those guys and, you know, fiddle around forever. Here's a statistic for you. From 2014 until today, the Justice Department has guess the Justice Department's conviction rate for ISIS-related terrorists.
72.
I think it's got to be like 106, 106%.
I'd go 97.
It's 100%. It's 100%. Wow.
That actually kind of disturbs me there then, because I'm not sure how.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. Like, if Donald Trump is like, we need to get a little tougher, and we literally have 100% conviction rate so far on people on, and this is ISIS specific, it looks like we have an 87% rate of resolved terrorism cases in the decade after 2001. So that's, I guess, a little bit lower. But
should we be talking about the Ground Zero Mosque then or something?
Yeah, probably.
If this isn't going to pan out to make hysteria, there's got to be something, you know, that we can pivot to.
And if not, we can ship him to Gitmo and quietly put him underneath the rug.
But here's the quote that makes me want to die. Kent Roach, an expert in comparative terrorism law at the University of Toronto, says, I cannot think of another country, except perhaps China, that would have a higher conviction and longer sentences in terrorism cases than in the United States. Wow. China, where they have great due process.
Hey, again, 24, they're efficient. They're at least very efficient.
Yeah.
So they've got that going.
Do you get to, you know, when they make the family buy the bullet, do you get a choice?
Or you get to pick the bullet? He's a good guy. We want to get him like a silver. We want to get him to carry like bullets.
I was just in England and I went to the Tower of London and they talked about how Anne Boleyn, when she was being beheaded, they actually, as part of a sign that, okay, you know, she was the queen and she committed adultery, or she was convicted of committing adultery and treason and of laughing at King Henry VIII's clothes, which I think is really what put her over the top. But as a gesture of kindness, they went and got a really good swordsman to chop her head off. So I don't know if in these executions, you can buy the good bullet that will actually kill him quickly, or you know,
splinters, you don't want that.
Yeah, it'll get the job done, but it'll just take two or three times as long.
Can we just hire Joe Pesci just to stab you in the trunk of a car?
Yeah, but even that, he was not good at his job. That's one of the reasons why he got whacked.
That's
spoiler
true.
Alert.
Before I leave, I'm going to do a completely unrelated historical tidbit I found out. Queen Elizabeth II's grandfather, they killed him. He was on his way out, and they gave him a fatal dose of morphine so that he would die in the evening so that his death would be reported by the more respectable morning newspapers than the tabloid news. So they timed his death to be more respectable. So anyway, they know how to do it over there. Earlier this week, another thing that happened was Congress had hearings on the advertising that Russia bought during the 2016 election. The ads were mostly produced by a Russian troll factory, and if you look at them, there's a few articles that we have on the website. The one that I really enjoy is by Jacob Sullum. They're very cartoonish. And they're very propagandistic and tend to focus on interest groups like anti-immigration, gun rights, LGBTQ, and from what we gather, were designed to sow discord in these United States and, depending on who you're talking to push Trump over the edge and get him elected. Meanwhile, there was a Harvard Harris poll that came out that said 49% of Americans believe Facebook feeds and Google search results should be regulated and based on political affiliation. So, Matt, in the wake of this, do you think there's apt to be a regulatory push, and do you think it would be deserved?
I'm sure that Congress will try to do something. I think that they will run up against a couple of problems. One is the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is being enforced with
horse and buggy thinking. Come on.
The current U.S. Supreme Court has been very vigorous about protecting speech writ large. And then just second, there's general congressional dysfunction about actually getting to a point where they're going to accomplish much of anything. I think we're in the grips of a minor hysteria over this stuff, over social media. I mean, you see people just use words like bots and these bots.
And sock puppets. That's the other one.
But it's more like this mechanical intelligence that can manipulate people's experiences and can be exposed to up to 140 million, as many as 140 million. Suddenly, these numbers, they're big. They must be meaningful. They must have done something. And you just never get a sense of what's the context in which they lived. I mean, are these 140 million drops in an ocean of a quadrillion drops of water? You don't get a sense of that. And I just don't understand, it's my own bubble, but, trying to imagine the effectiveness of any social media advertising. I mean, for me, the great tell that this was going to be a
for
bunch...
For Christ's sake, Andrew, you've never gotten laid off of Tinder, and you think Donald Trump is going to win because of a bunch of Russian trolls.
One time. One time.
He's changed his wardrobe.
I miss the early days of Facebook when you could throw a sheep at someone or send them a donut if you like them. Do you remember that?
Man, I don't even know what you're talking about. Is this some chat room?
No, I'm not...
None of that sounds... good.
But it's all true. It's all true. That's what Facebook was all about.
Before these hearings
Catherine
came out,
M. threw a sheep at you. Do you want to respond?
I was, thank God, that I spent the 90s somewhere else. But
this was the 2000s.
Facebook wasn't invented in the 90s.
Whatever. But right before these hearings, the tell of how stupid it all was and like where the fears were was when Twitter kicked off Russia Today from Twitter.
Yeah.
As if this has anything to do with
Lee Camp, he pushed it over the edge.
Anything. How many people are on Twitter? How many state-owned broadcast media companies are on Twitter? Why was it RT out of all of them that got kicked off? Let's think about it. It's just responding to.
We should throw the BBC off of Twitter.
Yeah.
Hey, Matt. Damn it. You were behind the East, or you were behind the Iron Curtain for part of the 90s, right?
No,
you weren't.
There wasn't an Iron Curtain in the 90s, except,
yeah.
I mean...
Jeez. I'm sorry, 89, yeah.
The Soviet Union collapsed in August of 91 or whatever.
Forgive me, but you...
It didn't collapse, it was pushed.
Thanks.
All right. Anyway, Matt, here's what I wanted to get at, because think you probably know Cold War history better than I do. A lot of the reaction that I'm seeing about this indicates that this is a new phenomenon, and I would guess that Russia's tried to interfere with elections in the past. I assume that this isn't a new thing. It's just the expression
and
of it.
And directionally, it goes in other directions, too, for crying out loud. I mean,
including Hillary Clinton openly campaigning against Putin and other people. I mean, it's
and against Brexit.
Yeah.
I mean,
we would never do that.
Reseeding people in Central America. I mean, it's
saying to Slovakia to pick out one random shitty country that no one really cares about. They had a lousy post-commie guy there named Vladimir Medchyar, who still, I think, is in the firmament of their politics. But he was sort of a proto-Trump type of character. Everyone would call him a dictator, and he wasn't, because it's still a kind of a democratic country. But all U.S. presidents are like, you know what? If you elect him, it's going to really jeopardize your chances of doing anything that you want vis-a-vis the United States of America. So just throwing that out there. You people do what you want. But that's what's important. I mean,
that is happening. And meanwhile, we're like freaking the hell out over a Facebook ad, which the text of which is literally Satan: if I win, Clinton wins! Jesus colon, not if I can help it, exclamation
they
mark.
They have Facebook accounts?
Press like to help Jesus win. That's it.
Can I, no. To push back, though.
And these are seen by, you know, they can spin it, as Matt was saying. They can magnify it.
Oh, that's great. We'll put that on the page.
To make it look like, a million people, a billion people saw this. In the end, very few people actually saw it. But
this screenshot says it has 97 reactions, Nick.
Okay,
so
there you
go. Democracy
that's,
is
and that's all it took. Well, what I was going to say is that this is also all coming out at exactly the same moment that Donna Brazile, who was Al Gore's campaign manager in 2000 and then became the interim head of the Democratic National Committee after Debbie Wasserman Schultz was kicked off a couple of months before the election in August of 2016. Is released, there was an excerpt from her forthcoming book in Politico where she talked about how in 2015, before Hillary Clinton was the Democratic National Committee, was the Democratic candidate, her campaign entered into a deal to give money to the DNC, which was broke, but then got to control all sorts of things that made it impossible for anybody to challenge Hillary Clinton as the nominee. And it's like, well, that is something that seems a lot more important than this threat, you know, this hysterical threat about Russian meddling in elections. And on top of it, it's coming out, you know, partly through, people in Hillary's campaign. She did not go. She chose not to do various things that would have won her the election in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And there is this prolonged attempt to In the interest, and I think sometimes it's in the hard interest and other times it's in the soft interest, or if people don't understand what they're doing, to somehow blame Hillary Clinton's loss on something other than Hillary Clinton's campaign. You know, and it's kind of a hard sell because Donald Trump won with the lowest percentage, in recent memory. He lost the popular vote. He barely squeaked into office. And Hillary Clinton's great triumph was to take an easy win and run it down into the ground so that she could lose by ultimately like less than 100,000 votes spread over three states.
Do you think Bernie would have beat him?
No, not necessarily, but it would have been different. And it's like the one thing that we do know for sure and that, you know, is inescapable is that the DNC was actually rigging the operation against Hillary against Bernie Sanders. And that's what Democrats should be really pissed off about. There's also Brazil also kind of hints at the idea that Joe Biden knew about this deal, and that's one of the reasons why he did not enter the race. And I think there's a plausible—
He knew about the deal? You mean the mechanisms in place is what he knew about?
Okay. Yeah, and so that, you know, and so he knew it would be a waste of time to run. I think it's likely, if not absolutely, you know, certain that he would have beaten Donald Trump.
Well, he was meeting with Elizabeth Warren like a couple of weeks before the announcement. If it had been a Biden-Warren ticket, that might have pushed through. Yeah.
There's, I think, a through line that you see in some of the kind of left of center panic over this, which is that a general tendency to believing that the average American, the average consumer of media, Facebook or whatever, is a sheep, is an individual sheep that can be manipulated. I mean, the words, I mean, look at the verbs that they use on MSNBC when they're talking about what happened with all these Facebook ads and the bots. It's always like manipulation, infiltrating, doing all this kind of stuff. And at heart is a belief that people are so gullible that they're actually going to be moved
by a
Facebook Jesus versus Satan thing or whatever fake news that you're scared of. It's not to say that that isn't there. It's not to say that the Russians, you know, weren't doing all that they could to get in there and muck things up. But if you start from a presumption that Americans are ignoramuses and just easily led towards bad places. And granted, I'm there much more than I used to be. but still, I think there's something kind of unseemly and condescending that undergirds some of the panic over these fancy, you know, social media sites.
I am both unseemly and condescending, so I'll own that position for a little bit. And I think this was a minor factor, but in the brief time I was on the Hill, I was doing constituent liaison work, and the sheer amount of phone calls I got that were a clearly bullshit forwarded email that someone read and was like, it's been typed. Clearly they hired a typesetter and this has been fact checked. And like really thought, like I would get phone calls where, you know, President Obama today said that veterans need to whine less. And I was like, even if he believed that, he wouldn't say that.
But I'm sorry that my dad was calling you so often.
Yeah, well, I got to strike up
a
good relationship
with
them.
Themselves.
Yeah. But there were a significant amount of people. I think there's a lot of people in the population that don't really understand that technology oftentimes has bullshit in it. And they just they see text and they assume that it's the same as a newspaper and something that is
which
that is
never
a thing.
Have bullshit in them. So
right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's fair enough. But like these the like crazy level conspiracy theory forwards that people do read and think is real all the time, like that is a portion of the populace, and that's the mouthy portion that tends to vote more.
There's also, I mean, there's. It's true that the internet, the social medias, and other modern technologies let people forward around false information or create and disseminate false information more easily, but it also lets them debunk it more easily. And that's not just a kind of like, it seems that'll all work out in the end. There are a bunch of academics working in this area, and some of them find stuff like, actually fewer people believe in alien abductions now than they did before the internet. Right.
Really?
So, like, just
kind of saddens me. I don't, but I kind of want them to keep going.
As like a basic, you know, it doesn't tell you whether or not people are still picking up dumb rumors and lies from the internet and sometimes believing them, but it does seem to suggest that there is nothing in this technology itself which has caused an explosion of false belief.
And this is the thing: is if Hillary Clinton had visited Wisconsin a couple of times, and if she had talked to. In Michigan, if she had gone to more United Auto Worker rallies, yeah, you know, she probably would have won. And I mean, for me, that's the whole wrapping this up. It's a technology scare, which we're used to, because every time a new technology gets discovered by Congress, which in true form is like 20 years after social media, like anybody gives a shit about the internet, Dianne Feinstein is probably, you know, is finally gargling with it. But then beyond that, the part that's really kind of incredible is the resurrection of Russians as like the, you know, the existential threat to Americans. I mean, I really thought we had closed that one out. 25 years ago.
I never did, Nick.
I was like, did. You know, this one, it was nice knowing you, but we're going to have to, you know, start, you know, having movies with Chinese people as the villains, which, of course, we can have because people like Matt Damon now are making movies for Chinese audiences.
That's true.
Which is kind of an interesting, I mean, this is a total pivot off of this, but what happens when one of your main global adversaries or villains has a market big enough to really change your popular culture, you know, which is what's
really,
happening.
Really, really bad
Hollywood.
CGI on the wall.
Yeah, probably.
More alien movies.
But it's interesting. Yeah, like or North Koreans, because in the remake of Red Dawn, at some point they swapped out Chinese as the villains.
But don't you think at least one thing that happens is like Americans think twice before engaging in bad ethnic caricatures for their villains because, those guys are never going to see this thing. Yeah. Like, that's pretty good. I'm in favor of that.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's kind of a new thing. Yeah, yeah. Well, he was Japanese, though.
Whatever.
Come on. Making fun of a Japanese guy in 1960, you know, that makes sense. We were still lording over the World War II thing.
Yeah, that only wound up around 1974, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. With the Tora, Tora, Tora. And we finally put it behind
us. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. Well, that was, we saw the war from both sides.
That's right.
Yeah.
I want our listeners to know that Andrew and I are just looking at each other waiting for this.
Well, I'm just letting it play out. I just want to see how far.
Wait, are you telling me you guys have never seen or heard of Tora, 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 which was a Hollywood
movie? I've
heard
of it, but never seen it.
Toshiro Mifune.
Is it about bullfighting?
Yeah, no, but it was about Pearl Harbor from both sides. So it was one of the major film, like U.S.-based films that showed the Japanese.
Like from the perspective of Zeros coming in?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to jump to another topic, which is taxes, because I thought what could be even better than Zeros. The House Republicans revealed their tax plan on Thursday. I'm not going to say what the bill would do because I think Catherine wrote a piece on it. Catherine, are taxes fixed now?
Totally. 100% fixed.
Great.
No problem.
Terrific.
We're done. No, the bill, which of course was sold as a major tax reform, overhaul, simplification, and path to a glorious new future, is in fact a tweak at best. It's some fiddling with marginal rates. It's a decrease in the corporate tax rate, which will sunset and go back up.
Really? It's not a permanent thing?
Well, they can't. So they're constrained by the need to be revenue neutral.
Right. So
and
it's like for a decade,
it's
right?
not. revenue neutral, the bill. So the way that they solve that problem is by just sort of waving their hands and saying like, oh, it's going to phase in slowly and then disappear. Mm. So the math will work out fine in the end.
And we'll all be retired by then. So it's fine.
And yeah. And also like the growth estimates in it are extremely optimistic in order, again, to sort of make the math try to sort of kind of work out. Mm. You know, the main thing is that there is no such thing as tax simplification. There will never be such a thing as tax simplification because politicians love to have the power of loopholes. They like to wield the power of giving benefits to special interests and to the classes of Americans to whom they want to appeal. You know, Republicans sound a teeny bit better than Democrats about this, but in fact enjoy that same power just as much, and we're doomed.
Well, did they in the final version of or the GOP reveal, did they keep the phase out of state and local tax rebates?
Or, state and local is at this moment.
It's still in
there? No, they're gone. Like
they've. Oh, that's going to be a thing for us here in New York, right, Max?
Wait, so that you're not able to deduct your state and local
correct.
Taxes from your federal taxes.
Correct, but there's good. some, it's not going to last at all.
Yeah, no, and also the mortgage interest deduction.
So mortgage interest deduction, you can still use that towards kind of state and local up till 10,000. Mm-hmm. So the mortgage interest deduction now on a new house, the limit is 500,000 instead of 1 million.
Right.
On existing mortgages, you're grandfathered in.
Is it one or two houses? Because you can own up to two houses.
I haven't seen language
mortgage.
On that. Maybe.
So if I'm renting an apartment and I live in New York City, yeah. I'm not getting any type of. This is just for me. I'm going to get screwed, right?
You're going to get
because I'm going to be paying the full force of all these taxes.
Yes,
you are now and have always been subsidizing. Home buying breeders in your home.
Yeah,
state.
I knew yeah. I was.
Well, the other
that.
Thing is that even you know New York State is one of the, and I realize this is kind of getting off the GOP plan, but you know all the red states, California, Massachusetts, Maryland, New York,
blue states,
big. I'm sorry, all the big blue states are subsidizing the
yeah.
red states, like you're from Oklahoma,
yeah, yeah.
where
we've actually got you know, a pretty good bang for a buck in Oklahoma.
Yeah, you get you know like New York probably gets like 50 cents back on
yeah,
every
New,
dollar.
New Jersey is the worst, as I recall. At least a couple yeah. years ago, New Jersey had the worst in terms of money they get back and the amount of taxes.
Having
they pay.
Said that, I do think in general. I mean, I agree with you. This isn't you know this isn't about tax simplification. And my pet peeve on all of this is that. Taxes should be equal to the amount of government that we're buying in a given year, you know, roughly, as opposed to last year we borrowed like 20 cents on every dollar that was spent. But I think it's a good thing if you shouldn't be able to deduct state and local taxes against your federal taxes. That would force states to compete at least slightly a little bit more on tax differences.
I'm not thrilled with what's going to happen to me personally.
But
it's not going to happen. It's worth pointing out. I mean, so in the kind of global view of this, the Senate passed their 10-year budget resolution, which of course is non-binding. It is of course. Based on so much fiction. We will cut something later. We're not going to tell you what it is now. We're going to have this much growth and all this kind of stuff. We're only going to spend $550 billion on military spending next year, even though we all know we're going to spend $700 billion. Like, literally, all that is in this fictitious document.
Military world's, spending doesn't count, man. Military spending's
world's
not a fact.
World's greatest deliberative body.
And so they passed this thing, which, even with all those rosy scenarios, increases the amount of federal spending in 10 years by $5.5 trillion. And they passed it and said, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to get $4 trillion in closing loopholes like the like mortgage interest and state and local taxes and other kind of corporate loopholes. And then so it's going to put the whole budget in $1.5 trillion in the red. So again, rosiest possible scenario. They say we're going to take $20 trillion and turn it into $21.5 over 10 years. The House, which spent 7 years politically saying no more debt, you know.
Yeah, I remember that. There was a whole thing.
It was kind of a thing in politics. The House, and they had passed their version of that budget previously as being deficit neutral because they want to do everything deficit neutral. They want to, you know, hurricane relief should be deficit neutral. They use that phrase $5 trillion times.
Obamacare was deficit neutral.
Obamacare was supposed to be deficit neutral. All this stuff. So the House, when faced with the Senate bill, like, okay, so is this going to go to conference committee? You guys going to hash this out? These are irreconcilable. They're like, all right, tax reform, cool. And they just signed it. And there was only about five, deficit hawks, fiscal conservatives like Justin Amash, the House Liberty Caucus, which is a teeny tiny little version of the House Freedom Caucus, was against it. And most of the Republicans that are against it were actually from New York and New Jersey who didn't like it because they could smell coming down the road the end of the state and local taxes. So It starts off as we were not going to cut spending. We're just not going to do it. We talked about it for 7 years, but we've given up. We're waved the white flag. So we can't do that. So let's at least cut taxes. That's a fun thought. And then, so you have that $4 trillion that they're supposed to go and get, right? Bob Corker, to name one senator who doesn't like Donald Trump.
Brave man.
Says that he won't vote for anything that's going to add one penny to the deficit. So, and he points out what's going to fill those $4 trillion. And the biggest ones are state and local and mortgage interest. And and there are more Republican legislators from California, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois combined than Republicans can afford to lose on tax reform in the House, let alone in the Senate. So that's just going to change. So when they finish caving on that, there's going to be very few loopholes. There's going to be very few simplifications because there's no courage to actually go after people like you and me and the freeloaders out there who are on the various
and looters.
The looters.
And looters.
And so it's going to make the debt even more spectacularly big than it was before. It's a beautiful clusterfuck.
Hey, Catherine, in the corporate tax rate stuff, they bring that down from what, like 35 to 20%?
Yeah.
That's the plan. And then is there the international tax holiday where companies won't have to pay profit taxes on money that they bring home?
You know, I actually don't know if we're repatriating our overseas profits. It's not something that I've heard.
One thing that I did see today was that they are only going to tax your overseas profits in places only when the profits are super high. So if you're a really super rich corporation with your overseas profits, so they're going to like try to figure out what that formula is, which sounds like a recipe.
I'm glad I trust them so much because I can't follow any of this.
Yeah. Right, and
but
that,
I'm sure
for instance,
they'll do the right
thing.
Yeah.
Like that new proposed rule is a great example of like that's the opposite of tax code simplification.
Right.
Like a magical, obscure formula where we decide whether or not you're a rich company based on criteria to be disclosed at a later date. That's not simplification. There's no universe in which that is a tax reform package that includes a rationalization or simplification of the tax code. And that is what everybody puts in their State of the Union for the last several presidencies and certainly what Republicans run
on. Fill out the taxes on a postcard.
Postcard taxes.
Who still is using postcards? I mean, it's like how
I
about
would go
an
back to using postcards if I could do my taxes.
Yeah.
On them.
No, that's probably true.
I only send postcards.
Do you
to
know?
Paul Ryan.
I think I forget where I saw it. But you know, why not have the government? Like they have all the relevant information. They could actually present you with your tax bill, which you could then challenge instead of.
I think that's what they do in the UK, don't they?
Yeah, like,
a variety
of countries.
That sounds like some Milton Friedman bullshit. Like that sounds like something we'll later regret, like making it super, super easy and basically invisible for the federal government to take your
money. I get that.
Like the withholding thing.
No,
which
I mean, I get that.
Sorry about that in the end, and you too will be sorry.
Do you want
about
to
that?
Have the government looking in Heaton's Bitcoin stash?
I keep spending more and more money. I'm now getting like TurboTax Supremo or something, and it keeps going up, and I still get like a bill later saying that I missed this or that. So, you know, at this point, if I could.
So basically, what you're saying is you're bad at doing your taxes.
Yeah,
could the feds
me and Tim Geithner. But you know that one day where you try to find out, okay, what was my Quicken password from last year, and then you're like, oh, and it's like you know the clock is ticking on midnight.
Nick's about like 3 years away from like answering the phone all day and saying, what? Is this an oil field in Kentucky?
My jitterbug phone. I won't even have to answer it; it'll answer itself.
But. Great. Good. I look forward to our taxes being simplified. So before we leave later tonight, the reason that Catherine and Nick are in town, I think, is for a debate on capitalism versus socialism with Jacobin.
Yeah.
And you two are representing capitalism.
Shit.
Well, that's actually.
Are we?
Yeah, no, then
I prepared for the wrong side.
I really messed up on that one.
Yes, we are representing capitalism.
I'm glad that you prepared for the wrong side because, Catherine, I wanted to ask you. First of all, is the resolution just capitalism's good or is it capitalism's better than socialism? How do they have it phrased?
I think it's capitalism a bad system or worst system.
Is that actually?
Yeah, that's the resolution.
That's it?
Yeah.
So, Catherine.
No, it's something along the lines of. Do you have the official thing? But it's something like, you know, the resolution is capitalism is a better way to ensure individual opportunity, okay, progress, and their opportunity or something.
And they're going to be swinging for proper socialism. They're coming in as.
Yeah, they're going to be swinging for market socialism, though, yeah. So we'll see. The resolution is, capitalism is the best way to improve standards of living, ensure political and economic freedom, and provide opportunity.
Okay.
Hmm. But these guys are interesting. The Jacobin people are, I think in many ways, our counterpart on the left. They are, they're real honest-to-God socialists, and they think, like, we got to get back to a political system where the working class holds the reins of power and where accumulation of capital is frowned upon and sometimes redistributed by the state, and where we embrace the idea that, you know, profit seeking is an idea whose time has come and gone. So they're like pretty hardcore, which I think is going to be fun.
How is that? So like a market socialist, would that be like a democratic socialist? And that's not what they're endorsing?
I don't think so. As a matter of fact,
we should probably let them speak for themselves.
Yeah,
but,
and we will. And this will all, it's going to be live streamed, and you know, we'll be showing it at Reason later. Once it's edited and all that kind of stuff, yep, and the audio is fixed. But I think market socialists mean that they're not against using market mechanisms to have the functioning of price systems and things like that. But then, and to be honest, this is something I they're very open about what they're talking about and stuff like that. But I don't fully understand. I don't know if you do, Catherine or Matt. When they talk about profit seeking is bad because profit seeking is you're expropriating
by which
labor.
You're trying to get a profit.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a sign that labor is being ripped off somehow,
right,
and that
working
class is important.
Are exploitative,
and so I don't know how you deal with that without a strong central state, which they seem to be against in many cases. I mean, they're against incarceration, and they challenge the idea that the government knows best on a lot of things. So,
okay,
you know,
well, so in preparation for it, Catherine, what's the best argument against capitalism?
That's a good question. I think the best argument against capitalism is probably the inequality argument, right? If you believe deeply, as many people do, that inequality matters a lot, and we should use extreme remedies to rectify it, then, yeah, capitalism definitely produces inequality. If you believe, as I do, that what matters is the overall welfare and happiness and self-actualization that people have the chance to experience, then I would say, even if the rich get crazy rich, the poor also get rich under even the flawed American 2017 model of capitalism, and that's what matters. So it's
yeah. And if I can follow up on that, because I've been thinking about this, as I get oldest, I find myself going back more and more to Joseph Schumpeter's work, the guy who coined the term creative destruction and whatnot, but. He said once he wrote, the capitalist achievement does not typically consist in providing more silk stockings for queens, but in bringing them within the reach of factory girls. And he also in this class thing, he noted each class resembles a hotel or an omnibus, always full, but always of different people. And so that not surprisingly, is the kind of patron saint of creative destruction, the idea that things are constantly churning and that capitalism, by which he meant essentially a system of free enterprise with private property rights that were tradable, creates a lot of disruption, but that it's all to the good because it actually ends up kind of allowing more people to become more fully who they are and that it's constantly changing. And I was looking at least in the United States, economic mobility rates, find three of Scott Winship at the Manhattan Institute just wrote a fantastic overview of the literature. Three of four adults are better off than their parents were at age 40. So we can always have more economic mobility, but we still have it. And that, I mean, for me, that's the argument for capitalism that kind of rebuts the economic inequality.
Well, I keep hearing that we've like now become a a static society where wages have declined and everybody's locked in. Is that
it's not true, okay. And it's especially not true outside of the United States or the developed the OECD countries.
That's what sticks in my craw about all this stuff. I've been listening to these people for 30 years, and all of their predictions about Eastern Europe. You read Noam Chomsky about what's going to go down in Eastern Europe in 1990, And he's like, you know, it's just going to be a tool for Japanese capital to enrich itself. You're like, what does Japanese capital mean? And why, what? There was this sense that there was going to be an international race to the bottom, which is language Bernie Sanders uses. For him, excuse me, all free trade is a race to the bottom. We've seen in the last 25 years the single greatest leap from extreme poverty to not extreme poverty in history. And that happened nowhere that I'm aware of because people followed Bernie Sanders's economic advice, that people were getting, you know, embracing their inner Jacobin. It was because they rejected their inner Jacobin entirely. They turned their back on the system. It was tried extensively. It sucked. It still sucks in a few places. And I don't understand how you look at 1 billion people coming out of poverty, extreme poverty, in 25 years and say, God damn it, capitalism sucks. It just doesn't make any sense.
It's one of the things that I'm disturbed by.
And I think it is true, or it's important to underscore the idea that the places where the biggest gains were made was because of increased trade and economic commerce. I mean, not because of foreign aid, not because of this or that.
Which is what the United Nations will tell you, is what Bono will tell you. I mean, it is a, like the UN Millennium Development Goals was to get rid of extreme poverty in a completely unrealistic scope, and we got there faster than they expected. And they do an annual report on this, and every year they're like, you know what? It was getting rid of trade barriers and state control of the economy by far more than anything else.
Those free market capitalists that are dominating the United Nations.
That's right.
I agree with you all on all these points. I'm kind of bothered by the fact that there appears to be, I don't know if this just happens in every generation, if there's a resurgence in sort of socialism. I feel like the word kind of got beaten out of the American lexicon from the you know, the Red Scare and all that. And it's creeping back in. I watched a clip that Colbert did the other night where he used socialism as a very favorable term. He was saying trick-or-treating, you're giving out candy, so that's socialism, which I take an intense disagreement with in terms of the actual meaning. Why does capitalism always wind up being a bad word? Like within particular libertarian circles, I find that sometimes they'll say, like, don't, you know, we should really get away from this branding. But why did that turn out to be a bad thing, Catherine?
So I actually just finished editing a Deirdre McCloskey column against the word capitalism. She is, of course, one of the most important historians of capitalism, and she hates that word.
Really?
Couple reasons. One, she says, listen, it overemphasizes the accumulation of capital, which is not actually the main thing about capitalism. And she prefers the incredibly unwieldy phrase, exchange-tested betterment.
Perfect. I was waiting for the libertarian branding to kick in.
And
Deirdre is an expert in rhetoric.
Exactly.
But she's actually right. That
exchange-tested, what was it?
Exchange-tested betterment,
which is
just trade, you know. But the idea that the reason that we had the great enrichment, right, the explosion of wealth that came after the Enlightenment, was not because someone got big piles of capital. People have had big piles of capital through all of human history from time to time, sometimes because they just forcibly take it from everyone around them, sometimes because they, you know, earned it by having a good crop that year or whatever, depending on the scale you're talking about. The thing that made the world suddenly incredibly richer, better, fairer, more fun was what she says is, you know, the idea of trade, the sort of double thank you of mutually beneficial trade, and the underlying idea of the bourgeois virtues, right? So she is the defender of the world, the word bourgeois, which will be the precise opposite of the Jacobin stance. Yeah. They are anti-bourgeois socialists in the old school sense. And she says, you know, the ideas of the virtues not being, you know, the old school martial virtues of, you know, I'm going to punch you and then, you know, celebrate my bravery, but prudence, thrift, fairness, you know.
Yeah, and a commitment to a system in which you might lose.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, because that's really...
To the rule of law, essentially, to the rules of the game, even in the absence guaranteed win.
We should, you know, I mean, you asked why is capitalism a dirty word, and I think part of it is because a lot of the times you see that that is not what happens. And when you think, if you think of somebody like Donald Trump, as a capitalist, you know, as a cigar-chomping, you know, monopoly
top
money guy.
Wearing.
Yeah. You know, he uses every tool at his disposal, including political power and political influence. And I think that, you know, and then when you see his children, none of whom I know, but when you see Donald Trump Jr. tweeting about you know, oh, that, you know, he takes half of his kids' candy, which is what inspired Colbert to do his bit. He tweeted that I took half of my kids' candy from Halloween to teach them about socialism. You know, it's like, yeah, you're a dick. And that's one of the big problems, you know, with capitalism. And I think that there's been an either an unwillingness or an inability to kind of talk about how, you know, what capitalism really is like a smartphone. Capitalism is, you know, Uber, when you live in a city that didn't have cabs and now you can get around using a different type of system. Capitalism is Whole Foods, which is not a shitty grocery store that doesn't really have anything in bad customer service, but rather it's, you know, laying in front of you in a totally voluntary, non-mercantilist colonial way, you know, great goods from all over the globe that everybody in that supply chain is better off because of Whole Foods. You know, I think, you know, we can say, I mean, we're all sitting here on a libertarian podcast of a magazine that's turning 50 next year. We've tried to do as well as we could, but we haven't tried, you know, we haven't been successful enough to kind of show capitalism with a human face. Oftentimes it's talked about as this brutal, you know, neo-Darwinian struggle of, you know, we squeeze out.
And prosperity gospel, there's a lot of things that get glommed onto it.
Yeah. So,
I'll adopt the, what was it again, the mutual exchange of...
Exchange-tested betterment.
That's perfect. I'm going to get the bumper
stickers.
Let's just
call that EBM, exchange,
ETB. We definitely need an acronym that no one knows.
Branding is a thing, because when I talk to people here in New York, if I say, like, well, I'm for, you know, property rights and open markets, like, that doesn't really bug people as much as, like, you know, I'm a capitalist, I own a top hat. People hate top hats. Nobody
likes. You do own a top hat.
I do own a top hat. Of course I own a top hat. Yeah, I went to the Royal Ascot one time, and I'm just everybody sopping wet with elegance. It was great.
What is the Royal Ascot? Is the Royal Ascot a gay bar or something?
That was where we went to after it. Yeah, okay. It's a big horse race in England. It's like the most English thing you could possibly
do.
Everybody's wandering around in top hats.
So even the horses have monocles and stuff.
Yeah, it's required by law. Okay. Otherwise, the Queen has to shoot them. Guys, I'm going to end it on that cheery note of horses being shot as a result of English law. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us and rate us on iTunes, and thank you for listening.